Hello, this is Chris Mansour with the Platypus Affiliated Society here. I'm in New York City with Brendan O'Neill. He is the editor of Spiked and a columnist for publications such as Big Issue, Reason, Telegraph, Spectator, and The Australian. And in 2015, he published a book titled A Duty to Offend, which is a selection of essays from these various outlets. Last night, Brendan helped host a conversation here in New York called Is the Left Eating Itself?, which was a panel discussion linked to an entire tour called the Unsafe Space Tour. They seem to be tackling issues such as campus culture, free speech, and Title IX, for instance. So welcome to the show, Brendan.
Hi, Chris.
One of the things I wanted to bring up immediately is to talk about your reflections on the Is the Left Eating Itself tour. I was there last night and watched the dynamic of the conversation, so I just wanted you to reflect on that and then talk about the original impetus of starting the entire tour.
Yeah, so last night's event was titled Is the Left Eating Itself? And it was a good, lively discussion. There was great audience feedback and questions. And it was me, Angus Johnston, Laura Kipnis, and Brett Weinstein on the panel. And there was more disagreement than I thought there would be. What became clear to me, and this feeds into the question of why we're doing the Unsafe Space Tour, is that the left is now not very good at defending freedom, and the right, in my view, is not very convincing in defending freedom. And I think that's the situation we currently face. So one of the reasons we want to do this tour is because we want to genuinely engage with people in the US who, like us, are struggling with where politics is at the moment, struggling with what to do about the undermining of freedom of speech, the growth of a new kind of petty authoritarianism or even kind of identity politics tyranny among younger leftists in particular, try and understand where that comes from, how much of a problem it is, and generate kind of intelligent, thoughtful debates about this problem, which try to historicize it a bit and politicize it, really to try and move away from the kind of alt-right pantomime that we've seen on campus in recent years, where some ridiculous alt-right figure will go onto a campus and scream at feminists for being censorious, and the feminists will scream back at them that they are fascists. All heat, no light. Neither side really believes in very much. And what we're trying to do is to turn this into more of a discussion about how we got here, historically speaking, and where we might go next.
And just for our listeners, you could actually see the live stream version of the event that happened last night, among the other ones, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that struck me about the conversation was that there seemed to be two strains in the end, where you had Laura Kipnis and Angus Johnston actually defending the idea of curtailing free speech on university campuses in particular for fascist or far-right organizations, where Brendan O'Neill and Brett Weinstein seem to be more what they call themselves First Amendment absolutists. One thing that I found an issue of the conversation that didn't really get brought up is that what ended up resorting between Laura Kipnis and Angus Johnston is that what it seemed like is that they were defending administrative apparatuses to kind of nix free speech, even if they were private entities. But with Brendan O'Neill and Brett Weinstein, it seemed like that they were resorting to the idea of very common basic enlightenment notions of being able to debate in public about reason. And I was just wondering what your reflections are on Laura and Angus's commentary on it and why you decided to always bring it back to basic enlightenment thought figures.
I was, as I said on the panel, I was incredibly surprised and disappointed by Kipnis in particular, because she has had her troubles with this kind of Kafkaesque rabbit hole that exists in relation to freedom of speech and also sex on campus, and she's been sucked into the kind of whole Title IX insanity. And yet she still angled all of her comments last night on the problem of absolute free speech and the need to restrict freedom of speech rights on campus for certain people, primarily Nazis and neo-fascists and white supremacists and so on. I thought that was incredibly disappointing. And it was very revealing, because what she effectively was saying is that she doesn't like the allies she has made since she became known as someone who stood up to crazy students. And she means the right. She doesn't like the fact that she has become allied with certain groups and people on the right. And I see this a lot now. I see a lot of sensible leftists and sensible liberals who are worried about the drift of politics, who are so desperate not to be called right-wing that they will end up either not saying something that they believe, like freedom of speech is wonderful, or they will water down their principles. I find that one of the most worrying things among American, sensible American leftists, even American radicals I've met, and also in Britain as well, that kind of desperate desire not to be in any way associated with the right, as if that's the worst thing that could ever happen, and therefore I'm not going to talk about free speech too much because that's what the right does. So that came through quite a lot. And then the question of why I kept bringing it back to Enlightenment values is because I think that's what's under attack now. And I think the left and the radical left really needs to recognize that the kind of founding values of the left itself, which was, you know, if you go back to the people who sat on the left side of the revolutionary French National Assembly, where the term the left comes from, you know, those values of reason and freedom and progress, we need to go back and recover them. Now, I know that the history of the left has basically been to say, well, those values can't actually be realized in a capitalist society. But I think that's not a good argument anymore, because not only are our societies failing to push through and come good on those values for everyone, which would have been our criticism 25, 30, 40 years ago, the problem now is that our society just simply doesn't believe in those values. So we've gone a step back. And that's why I think the left in particular needs to think about the kind of arguments it's making now and really think about going back to original bourgeois values, which were radical when they were first introduced and are still radical, as can be seen in the fact that if you defend freedom of speech today, or due process, or reason and objectivity over feeling and emotion on campus, for example, you will be shouted down. These are still radical ideas hundreds of years later.
But espousing radical ideas of bourgeois rights and the origins of bourgeois society, some of the early thinkers of the 19th and 20th century did critique the fact that these won't be able to be realized without organizing for socialist parties, for instance. Mm-hmm. Clearly, with the left in disarray today, we don't really have that kind of opportunity or apparatus to hinge onto and push forward the radical elements of bourgeois ideals of free and open speech further, meaning that we're still kind of reckoning with the fact that all of these all of the ideas such as free speech are being thwarted in the contradictions of capitalism. So I'm wondering, going back to these original ideas and trying to re-educate the audience to reflect on the radical character of them, how could we actually push them forward and implement them without a left leading it or a socialist party?
Well, my view is that the left is finished as a social force. I think it's over. We're witnessing the death throes of it now, and it's a zombie idea. It's a zombie institution. And I say that as someone who thinks that the left was probably the high point of human politics so far, but it failed, didn't work, didn't come good on its promises. It never lived up to its promise, and in every place in which it was tried, it wasn't good enough, it wasn't convincing enough, and as a consequence, over time, it is dying. And I think we should let it die. So my argument is, when I say the left must recover these values, I'm not saying that we need to resuscitate the left. I don't think we need to build a new socialist party, although people can do as they please, of course. We need to recognize the question of how those values came to be so demeaned, why that's such an important development and such a worrying development, and then think about new ways and new language and new ideas and maybe new institutions through which we can defend those values and seek to expand them. But, you know, when I meet radical leftists now and they say, oh, it's all very well talking about freedom of speech and the right to vote and so on, but as we all know, under the conditions of capitalist society, those values are phony or fake and do not really give people as much power as you might think. I think that's an excuse. I think that's an excuse by radical leftists who can wallow in the comfort of saying these values will never be real. until we have a revolution, even though they know the prospect of a revolution is virtually zero. So it becomes a deflection from the true, one of the key battles on our hands at the moment, which is the fact that the bourgeoisie has lost faith in itself and has lost faith in its founding values. The role of radicals in that period, whether you call yourself left-wing or liberal or whatever, the role of radicals in that period is to help the bourgeoisie recover a sense of itself. Because as a consequence of it losing faith in its values and its founding values, everyone else suffers as a result of that.
When you say it, you mean the left, the founding values, or bourgeois society?
The founding values of bourgeois society, which are the values which in different ways propelled the creation of the left. And the argument of the left, if you really wanted to boil it down, was that these values are really good. We love the idea of freedom and autonomy and comfort and wealth and the right to vote and the right to control politics. What we're saying is that you can't actually see that through under the conditions we live in. So that's history in one sentence. But I think we've moved on so far, and those bourgeois values are still so under attack, and even more so now than they've been in recent history, that the task of anyone who's serious about liberating mankind from poverty and tyranny is to defend those values wherever they're under attack.
Before I get into the idea that you think that the left would need to kind of establish new institutions and form of organizing, could you comment a little more on your claim that the left is in its death throes now? I want to know a little bit more about how you see the scope of history leading up to this point. Do you think that the death of the left is a recent phenomenon, or do you think it stretches back further into 19th or 20th century? Could you give our listeners a kind of genealogy of this trajectory?
I think it's been a long time coming. I think the end of the Cold War, 89, 1990, you know, that was really... that was the final nail in the coffin, in a sense, because then even the aspiration to be left, even the aspiration to have an alternative society to capitalism, kind of just collapsed. But I think it goes back further than that. I think you can also trace it to the 1950s and the 1960s, when you have the shift towards the new left, which is in essence a move away from questions of working classes and power and economy and growth and production towards issues of the problem of consumerism and the problem of advertising and the problem of the man and culture and how it impacts on people's view of themselves. And out of that, you get the whole sense of people not really being in control of their lives and being battered this and battered that and victims and so on and so forth. So the 50s and 60s is significant in the shift from the old left to the new left. But it really even goes back further than that, to the early 20th century, with the growth of social democratic movements, which, you know, were effectively a left-wing gloss on the desire of respectable sections of society to suppress the more revolutionary instincts of the working classes, and of course the defeat of various revolutions in Europe. So the history of the left is one of constant defeat. Some of them were glorious defeats and some of them were less glorious defeats, and we have to face up to that fact. And it would be incredibly surprising if any movement could survive 200 years or whatever it was of not quite making it and struggling and being defeated again and again, or defeating itself, which happened very often. And, you know, the evidence of the death of the left is all around us. You can see it in the fact that on campus now, being left-wing means having blue hair and thinking a man can become a woman by having an operation. I mean, this is what they think. This is what they think makes them Marxists. I've met these people, and they will say, I'm a radical Marxist, and therefore I think you should call me by my preferred gender pronoun, as if that has anything to do with being left-wing or Marxist. It's completely perverse. So and you can see it in the relation to the Corbynistas, which I know you want to talk about as well, where their idea of what it means to be Marxist is basically to have a little bit of nationalization here and there. Nationalization is not a radical proposal by any stretch of the imagination. So the twisting of the language, the the fact that these very prim and often quite posh middle-class people can flirt with the idea of being Marxist is testament, I think, to the death of Marxism. It's now just a meme, it's just a word, it's just a fashion pose, because it's been utterly hollowed out of its revolutionary potential and its disruptive potential. So the very fact that you can have new groups of people on campus and elsewhere calling themselves Marxists is, to me, proof of the death of Marxism and not the opposite.
What about the existing Marxist or anarchist or whomever that considers themselves on the left organizations that are just beyond campus culture or kind of cultural politics, such as issues with gender and sex and LGBT liberation and such of that? Like, what about what is your view on the existing organizations that still uphold, let's say, Maoist or Trotskyist tendencies?
I feel sorry for them. I think they need to call it a day. I think, well, I'm opposed to Maoism to begin with. Trotskyism I have less of a problem with. But I think they are exhausted and don't realize it. They are zombie movements. They are zombie organizations. They are using 20th century or in some cases 19th century language to try and negotiate the 21st century, which is like trying to go from the south of England to the north of England by only speaking Mongolian. It doesn't work. This language doesn't work. These ideas don't work. They're trying to force a square into a circle. And I think it becomes just a form of nostalgia. It becomes a comfort blanket. It becomes this sense that, and it becomes, in fact, a form of moral distinction. You can distinguish yourself from the mass of society. You can distinguish yourself from the people who watch the Kardashians or who read the tabloid newspapers or who like crappy pop music. You can increasingly, even among those kind of groups, radical leftism is a form of moral distinction against people who you see as being suffering from false consciousness. So I feel sorry for them. I think they are deluded in much of what they do. And I think too often among even radical Marxists and Trotskyists and Maoists and so on, it's less that they want to engage with the mass of society, that they want to just be sad about the mass of society, and I don't like that.
So your main critique is that the concepts related to the left and Marxism is that it boils down to a taste community rather than having political purchase in 2017?
I think it's both of those things. I think it's a badge. Marxism is now a badge, or it's a meme. You know, the Corbynistas have turned Marx into a meme. They make memes. Seizing the memes of production, which is funny, right? But it's also tragic, and they're not joking. That they really think a meme with a picture of Marx and a quote from Corbyn, they think that's Marxism. I mean, it's beyond tragic. So it's partly that it's just become this pose. It's just become this garb you put on to signal your intelligence, I guess. But it's also that these ideas are exhausted ideas. Now, that's not to say that the attitude of Marxism is exhausted. I've always liked the idea of Marxism as an approach to society. Marxism might not even be the right word for it, but that kind of very critical approach, which is appreciative of the role of humanity throughout history, which is very sensitive to social and historical developments, keen to understand them in the historical trajectory of struggle and so on. That kind of approach to understanding the world is very positive, but the idea that the answers to the problems we face will be found in the Communist Manifesto or Capital or anything else, that's a fantasy. And that's when they really do turn Marxism into a kind of religion which provides the answers to the problems of capitalist society, and that's never what it was intended to be.
I think this pings back to the idea that we need to form new institutions, because it brings up questions of old political forms or old political language, such as espoused by the early Marxists, of how much purchase they have. I mean, is the idea, it's not simply semantics, right? Like when Rosa Luxemburg defended the Vanguard Party or something like that, and we look at what we consider the Vanguard Party today in sectarian groups such as Trotskyist or Maoist, and you say, well, it seems to not really ring true today. When you want to start something new, are you saying that we need to salvage some of these ideas and terms and kind of make them good on these updated and transformed times? Or are you saying that we should just kind of pitch them out to the can altogether and reimagine something totally new?
Yeah, but the thing is, when Rosa Luxemburg was defending the idea of the vanguard party, that was in a revolutionary climate. That's when Europe was in revolt in many different places. We don't have anything like that today. So a vanguard party becomes something completely different. It doesn't become a party that wants to lead this furious throng of people who are educating themselves and desiring to take power and desiring to take control and agitating for greater pay or comfort or freedom. That doesn't exist. Now, a vanguard party in those circumstances is a great idea to lead and mould and inspire that desire. When you don't have that, you just have a completely unrevolutionary moment in most instances. A vanguard party becomes an entirely different prospect. It becomes one about looking down upon ordinary people and wondering when the hell are they going to get revolutionary? What is wrong with them? And that's when you have, you know, a lot of radicals in America and Europe often find themselves drawn to foreign zones. You know, they love Cuba, for example. They will go on these kind of political holidays to Cuba, or they will get extremely excited about what's happening in Venezuela and so on, because they get so frustrated and so disappointed with ordinary people in their own society that they come to actually loathe them to a certain extent, and they're always looking for evidence of revolution around the world. So, I just think that those parties and those organizational formats, it's done and dusted, and it's been done and dusted for a long, long time. So I think anyone who was to set up a Marxist party today would be making a grave mistake, really and truly, because that's not where politics is at, and that's not where politics is going to be at ever again. And I think the sooner we face up to that, then the sooner we can start thinking about new ideas and possibly new institutions through which we can pursue the radical improvement of human life. I don't know what form that will take. I simply know that the working classes are entirely different to they were 100 years ago and have different ideas. And if they're hated by anyone, it's more by the left than it is by the bourgeoisie. So things have changed beyond recognition, and I think to create a Marxist or Trotskyist or Maoist party today is surreal, in my view.
But then this might beg the question about your pursuit of kind of hearkening back to Enlightenment values, because of course they should be defended, but on the other hand, when the idea of free will and focusing on individual autonomy and notions such as that, these were formed at a period when they didn't experience the kind of crisis they do in modern society until industrial capitalism brought. In other words, it was a critique of historical development that Marxists saw. So I'm wondering how you think that we could actually build a revolutionary moment by simply revisiting moments of Enlightenment values if they did experience a crisis between then and now. I mean, how could we actually make good on that and really push forward the contradictions experienced in capitalism through Enlightenment value, how Enlightenment values undermine themselves within the 20th century. I mean, it's, you know, for good and ill, many Marxist groups failed at actually pushing forward with that mission, but it seems like in some cases that they were right to point out how history developed and put some of those notions in the crisis. So I guess my question in general is, how could simply going back to reintroducing Enlightenment values and individual autonomy and notions such as that, how could we actually circumvent, can we address them without circumventing the history and kind of avoiding the problems that they experienced through time?
You can do either, I think. Obviously a historical understanding of where these values come from and the failure to act on them, whether it was after the American Revolution or the French Revolution or the English Revolution or whatever it was, and the undermining of them at certain periods in time and then the kind of flourishing of them in other periods and so on. You know, it's a long and complicated process where these values have proved to be usually quite elusive for most people. So yes, a historical understanding of that is very important, but I think I feel that I cannot overstate how important it is to defend these values. And, you know, the idea of individual autonomy, I think, is the most important value to defend. And the point I make to leftists, like, for example, Corbynistas, who I know more about, is, you know, they have all these kind of policies that come from Jeremy Corbyn and which are promoted by his radical left-wing supporters, supposedly, about restricting the amount of money people can spend in gambling places, restricting the advertising of junk food so that children and don't pressure their parents to buy them junk food. There was one proposal in their draft manifesto prior to the general election in which they wanted to focus on getting gay people and black people to stop smoking, because there are high levels of smoking in those communities. And I just keep saying to these people, if you don't trust people to decide whether or not to smoke, if you don't trust them to decide how much they should spend on a gambling machine, if you don't trust them to decide what to feed their children, don't you dare tell me that you trust them to have a revolution or to organize society or to transform society and make it in a better, more radical, freer, wealthier place. This is the issue. The issue is that you cannot have revolutionary politics. You cannot have left-wing politics unless you have the idea of the individual. Now, more recently, the left has, particularly from the period of the New Left onwards, the left has had this idea that there is this profound contradiction between individualism and collectivism, and that you can only have one or the other. And so Reaganism and Thatcherism is all about the individual, and then better forms of social democracy, and then particularly radicalism, is all about collectivism. That's a false dichotomy, utterly false dichotomy. Anyone who knows anything about history will know that stronger individuals who have freedom and self-respect and democracy and may even have tasted some of that in a small little revolutionary process are more likely to then contribute to a really strong collective movement or collective entity. And that, in turn, that collectivism can feed into the sense of individualism and the sense of wanting to take responsibility for society or the people you live with or the people you're doing politics with. So they're intimately bound up. But the only thing I can say for sure in relation to this relationship is that without a defense of the human subject, without the defense of the idea that we have free will, we are capable of making choices, we are capable of autonomy and should be granted autonomy, or we should seize autonomy, without that building block of the individual, you will never have any form of revolutionary politics. You will only have a politics which is about correcting or helping or re-educating damaged individuals. And that's what's happened to the left. The left has become so down on the idea of individualism, which it thinks is evil, that it now has convinced itself that people are fragile and weak and not sure how to negotiate life. And therefore, they need to have this bureaucratic scaffolding built up around every aspect of their life. So the left's abandonment of the idea of individual autonomy has given rise to a left that is deeply unpleasant and paternalistic. So I think defending the idea of individual autonomy, which comes from the Enlightenment, which comes from Kant's What is Enlightenment, which is basically an argument against the nanny state. It's a remarkable if you read it now. So he says, I have a pastor who thinks for me, a book that tells me what to eat, health experts who are always telling me how I should live. And he calls them the guardians, these guardians telling me what to do. And all I want to do is strike out and dare to know and use my reason and so on. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. That's the kind of thing we need to defend and restate today. Because without individual autonomy, society doesn't work. And revolutionary politics is impossible.
So you think that your effort in trying to bolster the classic bourgeois notions of individual autonomy, free speech, and such as that will actually help allow for the conditions for a collective subject to grow that would bolster more revolutionary ambitions in the future?
That, well, it might do. It's hard to know which direction it will go in.
It's a gamble for you.
It's a gamble, but I think it makes society a better place if people are free. Because then they are responsible for their lives, responsible for the decisions they make, and they're likely to be more rounded human beings as a consequence of that. And I think, you know, we sometimes forget how radical bourgeois ideas were when they first came around. I mean, these were incredibly radical ideas. I mean, I always like to go back to the period of the English Civil War in the 1640s, when Christopher Hill, the left-wing historian, in 1972 wrote a book about the English Civil War called The World Turned Upside Down. I mean, that's what happened. What happened in that 10-year period from 1642 to 1651, when there was a war between parliamentarians and monarchists, of course, the world was turned upside down, because every single idea in society, every single institution was called into question. Religion was called into question, the power of the church was called into question, the rights of priests, the rights of kings, everything was called into question. This was more radical than anything that came after it in some ways, in terms of the break that it represented. And you had people on street corners handing out leaflets, and they were in pubs trying to convince others, let's kill the king. So we sometimes forget, you know, because bourgeois now is an insult, right? I used it as an insult in last night's debate. I said Antifa is bourgeois. So we usually use the word bourgeois as an insult. And especially those of us on the left or from the left or who've been around the left will often think that the bourgeoisie is a problem. But I think we need to think back to and possibly recover some of the radicalism that the bourgeoisie was, which the bourgeoisie foisted onto the world, which was incredibly dangerous and important. That's the kind of thing we need to talk about, because without those founding ideas, nothing else is possible. Nothing else is possible, especially revolution. You can't have a revolution that is led or peopled by individuals who aren't trusted whether or not to give their children hamburgers. It's not possible.
So since we're talking about the origins of bourgeois ideals, it might be a good segue into talking about some of the origins of your political activity and how you found yourself to become, as you declare, a Marxist. Could you talk about your early involvement with the RCP and Living Marxism, what got you interested in politics and Marxism in specific, and how it kind of led you to the sense that you need to defend bourgeois ideals in order to see perhaps a relevant Marxism in the future?
Yeah, so I joined the Revolutionary Communist Party, which was a fairly small revolutionary communist group in Britain in the 1980s and 90s, and I joined in around 93, when I would have been 18 or 19, I think, and I knew that I was left-wing, I felt left-wing, I'd been reading left-wing writers, Trotsky and Lenin and others, and I had this idea, probably a fairly juvenile idea, that I was a left-winger or a radical. So I was kind of looking for organisations or groups that I might join or might hang around with and suss them out and see what they were like. And the left in Britain of that, the radical left in Britain of that period was just so depressing. I mean, they even looked depressing. They didn't dress particularly well. I know that sounds shallow, but they were intellectually quite bovine. They did not take ideas seriously at all. They just were only interested in action, 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 action. Any protest that grew up, they would line up behind it uncritically, get overexcited about it. Just this real chasing the coattails of any blip in society. And I just felt that was lazy and boring. And then I just found the RCP far more intriguing and far more interesting. It was a group that was, they dressed well, so that impressed me. They took ideas incredibly seriously. I mean, intensive discussions about all sorts of ideas and books and things. They were friendly. They were incredibly professional. So the magazines that we produced, Living Marxism, was incredibly professional, looked great, was full of fantastic content. So all of that made a difference, because it really made me think that if you're going to be on the left, if you're going to be a radical on the streets arguing for some pretty radical ideas, then you should take yourself seriously and you should take other people seriously. The key dividing line between the RCP and the whole of the left in Britain was over the question of the state. This was the real issue. The RCP was always anti-state and always questioned the idea that the state was the solution to the problems facing society. The rest of the left at that point, including the radical left, but obviously the Labour Party, but the rest of the left was increasingly seeing the state as the solution, as the only real agent of change in society, as the institution which should tame capitalism and assist poor people and govern everyday life and police interactions between different communities. And the view of the RCP was that it's only because the left is now so out of touch with working class people and ordinary people that it finds itself moving closer and closer into the bosom of the state. And I think the left's self-entanglement with the state is the most depressing political story of the 20th century. And the RCP did its bit to argue for seeing people as the solution to problems and ordinary people as capable of governing their own lives and not trusting or asking the state to look after us, whatever the vagaries of capitalism might be.
And how would the people, which is a relatively nebulous term, actually organize themselves to become self-sufficient in that way? I mean, and then also the RCP's critique of the state, was it just simply a critique of the bourgeois state, or was it actually a critique of some of the old models that leftists and Marxists would need to actually overrun the state? And take it over, expropriate the ruling class, and seize the state themselves in order to transition out of the necessity of the state.
Yeah, I think a lot of Marxists and radicals now will often use that old radical idea of seizing the state in order to move on to a new kind of society, or in order to destroy the old society, in fact. They often use that argument now, I'm not saying you're doing this, but they often use that argument to justify their support for the state today. So they use it as a way of saying, look, we're not always anti-state because we recognize that there might come a historic moment when we have to seize the state and use it to our ends. And they often, I've heard people use that to justify the expansion of the welfare state, for example, or justify the expansion of the state into certain areas of political life. And that is a profound misreading of what those early radical Marxists were saying, which was that out of necessity and by regret, you might need to seize these means in order to effectively defeat the old class and then move on to something else. You know, what those people wanted was the withering away of the state, and the left just doesn't call for that now. In fact, it constantly calls, particularly now. In the 80s and 90s, there might have been some discomfort among the left with what they were doing in relation to the state, but now it's uncritical and unquestioned. They think the state is people's best bet, and they want to grow the state and expand it into ever more areas of people's lives. They think the welfare state is wonderful. I mean, the Corbynistas, for example, and other European radicals, they very rarely argue for things like full employment now. You never see a demonstration, as you would have done 30 or 40, maybe even longer, years ago, where people would have been on the streets demanding full employment. You never see that now. Instead, the only thing that gets them out active on the streets is when there's any Tory or right-wing attack on the welfare state. Then they're out there defending the welfare state, which is effectively defending the institutionalization of unemployment and poverty. I find that deeply alarming. The question of the state is, I think that, you know, that question of, well, won't we need the state for a temporary period at some point in the future after revolution? It's too much of a fantasy. I can't even handle thinking about that. All I know right now in this society is that the state is a largely destructive force, and it's doing far too much of what it shouldn't be doing, which is offering an apology for poverty and unemployment through the expansion of the welfare state and policing ever more areas of our lives. And it's not doing enough of what it probably should be doing, which is investing a little bit in research, production, growth, new areas of technology, and so on. So the state is completely topsy-turvy. Too much governing of people and families and communities, and not enough ignition of the creative destruction and the new forms of investment that might actually move us on from the recession we currently find ourselves in. So the state is a failure across the board, and I find it terrifying and deeply depressing that the left thinks the state is the solution to anything.
Well, if I understand my history correctly, though, it seems that the rise of the state was to kind of act as a custodian for capitalist crises. Mm. So it seems to me that, although I disagree that we should be reliant on the state, because in many ways it does thwart our autonomy, that if you kind of created a more laissez-faire condition and invested more energy into civil society and capitalist development and growth, that you would just have a new crisis come about. I'm not defending the state by any means, but I'm just wondering that how would that actually transform the conditions where it appears that the state is necessary to kind of recorrect capitalism when it's in crisis, when it's experienced a crisis.
I think the left or radicals or whatever we want to call ourselves these days just need to get over their attachment to the state in all areas of life. The example I always give is in Britain in the 1980s, under Thatcher, huge numbers of people lost their jobs. The mines were shut down. People in the manufacturing side of industry in particular suffered. And what happened is that in the mid-70s, the government introduced this new thing called incapacity benefit, which was this idea that you're just vaguely incapable of work. It's not that you are physically disabled or crippled or anything like that, or mentally ill. It was just this new vague term, you're incapable. And then what happened in the 80s is that the number of people in Britain getting incapacity benefit rose exponentially. I think it started off in 1980 with 100,000, and by the end of the decade, it was 1 million. So what happened? So this sums up how sinister the state is. What happened is that hundreds of thousands of people lost their jobs. Instead of us honestly saying to them, you're unemployed, capitalist society has failed, and this is really, really bad, and we should do something about it. Instead, what happened is the state, completely and utterly aided and abetted by the left, particularly the public sector left, promoted this idea of incapacity. So you're just incapable. Somehow, we don't quite know how, but it's your own physical failings, your individual failings, which means that you no longer have work. That's disgraceful and depraved and anti-human, and that to me sums up the problem with the state, including the welfare state, which is, and this is a point that actually radicals and working class movements made in Britain in the early 20th century when we had very early forms of the welfare state. Of course, it didn't get institutionalized until the post-war period, but the argument they always made is, oh well, we're really worried about this because you'll just use it as an excuse for not giving us the jobs we want to have, because it gives us more self-respect and self-control and greater wealth and prosperity and a sense of individual strength and community strength, so we want that, please. And they were absolutely right to say that that's what the welfare state would become, and that's what it did become and what it's becoming more and more across the board. Whenever I hear left-wingers, particularly radical left-wingers, on the streets defending the welfare state, I want to shake them. I want to shake them by the scruff of their neck, and I want to say to them, the welfare state, you know, everyone agrees that if someone is incredibly poor and cannot feed themselves, that society ought to help them. That's a civilized thing to do. But the creation of this vast Byzantine bureaucratic institution, which now governs and feeds and looks after millions of people, including millions of unemployed people, is not something the left should support by any stretch of the imagination. So it's that kind of uncritical, unquestioning attachment to the state, even when it's being explicitly destructive of individual potential and social solidarity, because this is the other thing. It doesn't only undermine individual autonomy, it rips apart social solidarity, because the more individuals and families are encouraged to look to the state for assistance in times of need, the less likely they are to look to their neighbours or their community or their families, and the less likely then that those social bonds will form and become tough and become tighter. So it destroys individual autonomy, it destroys social bonds, it presents the failings of capitalism as the failings of individuals, and it has no solution to creating more wealth and creating more jobs. Anyone who supports that loses the right to call themselves left-wing, in my view.
It strikes me that because we've been talking about the failure of the left and the lack of autonomy most people have and how everyone is atomized in this kind of historical situation. So if the state were to disappear, I guess what I'm saying is that I still feel like that the contradictions of capitalism isn't quite figuring into this critique, because even if the state didn't exist as a kind of platform for welfare, people would still, in this state, people would, I'm sorry, not state, but like in this social situation, people would still be atomized because they don't have a binding organizational force to bring them together and have greater autonomy. So I'm just wondering, I mean, perhaps it's a quagmire and we don't quite have an answer for it, but I'm just wondering how you actually envision people to have some kind of form of autonomy in a world where perhaps the welfare state isn't really pressuring them down and keeping them down as the way you've been putting it.
I think, you know, people often say to me, because I'm incredibly critical of the welfare state from what I consider to be a left-wing perspective, and people will often say to me, but if we didn't have the welfare state, what would happen? How would people feed themselves? Let's, you know, if you accept the fact that they're unemployed, if you accept the fact that they struggle to make ends meet, you know, what would happen? What terrible things would happen? But I want to turn the question around. What terrible things are happening now as a consequence of the existence of the welfare state? That's the question I want to ask. And it seems to me that there is a long list of terrible things that are happening. And at the near the top of that list is the way in which the state repackages the failures of modern bourgeois society to provide gainful employment for all people as just an accident, or possibly even your fault, or something you shouldn't particularly worry about because it's fine, you've got enough money to live on, so it's cool. It's pulling the wool over people's eyes. It's and, you know, if you look at opinion polls in Britain, it's very, very interesting because the people who are most pro-welfare state are the middle classes, and the people who are most critical of the welfare state, and they're often critical of it because they think people are sponging or taking money they shouldn't have and so on, and I don't necessarily have a problem with people thinking that, but it tends to be a rather narrow critique. However, the people who are most critical of the welfare state are the working classes and the poor and the people who will know people who use the welfare state or who even may use it themselves. They don't like it. I think that's fascinating because what we've created in Britain, and I'm sure this is the case in other Western nations too, we have created this modern day feudalistic racket where millions of middle class people are employed, so they are paid and they get their sense of moral purpose too, from looking after millions of poorer people. So I think that's wrong, and I think that's created a divided and destructive form of social organisation. I would prefer if those middle-class people did something more productive than constantly lecturing or looking after the little people, and I'd prefer that working-class and poor people had far more independence in their lives. I'm not saying the state will or should disappear. I think the state has to exist in some format because of the society we live in and just in terms of basic functioning of everyday life. But I certainly think it should be shrunk. I certainly think it should be rolled back. And I know if you say that, people think you're a Reaganite. I certainly think we should be far more critical of it, even when we're inviting it to do certain things. For example, the creative destruction of zombie business and the investment in new forms of technology, even as we invite it to do that kind of thing, and I think it should do that, we should still be very critical of the state as an idea. But it's that lack of criticism of it, that, you know, this way in which people say, oh, let's nationalize this, let's nationalize that, as if, and they say it in such a cavalier way, as if the state will make everything better, when evidence suggests that that's simply not the case.
Let's go back to this, actually, where you say that you get a common criticism of being a Reaganite for supporting the idea that the state should shrink and its kind of overreach on everyday citizens. I think this actually plays well into some of your recent commentary on Brexit, because the general critique that you had, which was the introduction of more neoliberal reforms in Europe, was that the EU became a technocratic overreaching entity that actually made it more difficult for sovereignty to happen within various countries of Europe. And I'm wondering how you envision a kind of shrinking of the state's role would happen with the situation like Brexit and other countries potentially leaving the EU. So I guess I have a two-tiered question here. One is that maybe you could go in for our listeners a little bit about what your general critique of the EU is and why you did take a pro-Brexit stance that wasn't necessarily in line with the Conservative Party that is now leading it, with May, and then also how you envision a future Britain that would actually allow greater autonomy among its citizens, but not just Britain. I mean, we're talking about world citizens here too.
Theresa May is not pro-Brexit. I mean, she was on the side of Remain. She's having to lead it now, but she doesn't believe in it, and that's why she's making such a terrible, terrible job of it and could actually destroy it, which would be worrying. I think Brexit is the best thing to happen in Western politics in a generation. Because what you had, and you know, there are many nails in the coffin of the left. I think it's possible that the final nail in the coffin of the left is its failure to recognise the progressive radical impetus behind Brexit. It's so shocking to me that the left, well, large sections of the left, have written Brexit off as a neo-fascist cry or xenophobia or little Englandism. And what they've done, this is a very, very serious problem. What they've done is, what the Western elites have done is they have turned their own crisis, so they suffered the crisis of Brexit because we all defied them and voted for Brexit. They suffered in the US because people went for Trump when the entire media and everyone else were saying, please go for Hillary. So they're on the back foot because ordinary people have said, screw you, we're going to do something different and we're not going to do what you tell us to do. And so the only way in which Western elites can make sense of that is by arguing that the people have gone crazy and they're turning fascistic and they are post-truth and they are low information and they are falling for the rule of demagogues and they are demonstrating that democracy might be a bad idea. That's how these very aloof technocratic elites have made sense of that. To its lasting, historic, mortifying shame, the left has accepted that presentation of what's going on. The left has bought into the bourgeoisie's extrapolation of its own crisis and its transformation of that into an attack on the demos and the whole idea of democracy. That is probably the gravest error the left has made in years. Brexit is wonderful for two reasons. Firstly, because the EU needs to be destroyed. And the EU needs to be destroyed because it is anti-democratic. It has forced unelected governments on Italy and Greece. It has overridden democratic votes in Holland, France and Ireland. It is currently trying to override Brexit, which is the largest democratic vote in British history. So it's undemocratic. It's neoliberal in the sense that it elevates the needs of the European Central Bank and the European capitalist class above any working classes, particularly the Greek working classes, which it has plunged into poverty. Also the Spanish working classes, it's removed Spain's economic independence and forced them to push through austerity measures. Also Ireland, where the troika of powers went to Ireland and basically took control of the country and forced wage cuts and so on and so forth. So it destroys the working classes and their living standards. That's the second thing. And the third thing is it's racist. It has a two-tier, explicitly racist migration policy where it celebrates constantly the freedom of movement it grants to people who live in the EU, who are predominantly white people, obviously not exclusively. And yet at the same time, it is enforcing ever more barbaric measures on its Mediterranean coast to prevent any black people from Africa from getting near the continent. And in fact, it's even paying African dictators to keep their people out, to basically force them to stay where they don't want to stay. So it's undemocratic, it's neoliberal, it's anti-working class, and it's racist. I find it horrifying that anyone who calls themselves left-wing would support that. So the first reason Brexit's good is because the EU needs to be destroyed, and the more people who vote against it, the better. The second reason is because it was one of the first acts of mass public defiance in years. Because everyone, I cannot explain to you what the atmosphere was like. Every single figure of authority, 80% of MPs, around 75% of the business class, every global institution, the White House, the UN, everyone with any power, the cultural elite, the celebrity set, the liberal media, were on their knees begging us to vote Remain, pleading with us to keep the EU together. And 17.4 million people said no. Fuck you, we're going to do something different. And so that to me represents democracy in action. And this brings us back to the question of why we're defending bourgeois values. Brexit explains to us why we have to defend something like bourgeois democracy. Because even within that narrow field, which we all agree is not enough, you can still deliver one of the gravest body blows to the 21st century capitalist class. That's what the people of Britain did. That's worth cherishing. It was a great blow for democracy and against a great blow against technocracy. The left needs to recognize that.
We're running low on time, but I would like you to just briefly follow up on the idea that this is kind of a blowback, or the working class given a voice to refuse the trajectory of the way things were going with Brexit. How will the working class actually make good on this possibility with a lack of left leadership?
Well, that remains to be seen. But the most admirable thing about what's happening in Britain at the moment is that despite the fact that the intellectual and political elite constantly says Brexit's the worst thing that's ever happened, and the left is buying into that nonsense, people who voted for it are sticking by what they voted for. Now, I can't quite work out where they get this resolve from, where they get this ability to refuse to listen to the fear-mongering, to block out this constant daily demonization and libel against them. But somehow they have this resolve, they have this strength, they have this individual and community sense of themselves. And I think that is something really genuinely worth celebrating. So I don't quite know where it's going to go, and I don't know what society will look like after Brexit. I simply know that people defied the establishment, defied the European elites, defied a capitalist class that has been destroying the European working class over the past 10 years, and made a stand against all that, and are sticking by the stand they made. Wherever that's coming from, there's no leadership to it, but wherever it's coming from and whatever it is sustaining it, that's what we need to tap into now, and that could be the beginning of a new politics.
So you see this as a potential new beginning and a good final nail in the coffin to the what you kind of see as a pseudo-left?
I think it's the final nail. I hope it's a nail in the coffin of the technocracy and those people who have spent the past few decades freezing politics and freezing history and freezing the great questions of history, like power and sovereignty and class and nationhood and democracy. All those are... The European Union is like a lid on all those bubbling questions of history. It's like a technocratic lid saying, well, let's just make politics all about expertise and technical management. Forget all those profound moral and political unresolved questions of history. So in blowing that lid off, we have hopefully unfrozen history, unfrozen those great unresolved questions of why bourgeois values can't be come good on, or why some people hate democracy and other people think it's quite important. All those questions of the EU was explicitly designed to suppress in preference of making politics a very managerial thing done by experts. All those questions are now potentially back in the public realm. That's incredibly exciting. It's a great opportunity for radicals, whatever side of the spectrum they come from, and it's a great opportunity for rethinking politics and maybe doing something different. As to where it will go, I have no idea, but that's another thing I think is quite exciting.
All right, great. Thank you. That was Brendan O'Neill with Spiked. You could check out more information on the Unsafe Space Tour on their website. And thank you for listening. Take care.